Okay, well, last week Sean gave an introduction to the book of Genesis, and if you weren't here last week, I encourage you to go back and listen to that message. And so now we're going to start into chapter 1, which Pat read for us this morning. And we're going to spend several weeks really in chapter 1 dealing with some of the broad questions and themes in the chapter. Genesis 1 is a wonderful chapter, and it's the account of God creating the universe. It's one many of us are familiar with, even many non-churchgoers. This is a familiar passage. It's simple enough that we can teach it to our children, but it's also sophisticated enough that it keeps adults, even scholars, coming back century after century. And so one of the things we want to insist on during this study through Genesis is that the Word of God, and including the book of Genesis, is just always relevant. It's always good for us. These early chapters, they really are timeless. It deals with questions like, where did everything come from? Where did we come from? What went wrong? How did things get to be the way they are? In the next couple weeks, we'll be looking at what does Genesis 1 teach and reveal to us about God? What does it show us about ourselves? What does it show us about the world that God made? So kind of what's the theology of Genesis 1? We're also going to look at what does it mean that man and woman are created in God's image? What implications does that have for how we live in the world, how we treat one another? This morning, though, we're going to deal with some prior questions, some kind of more foundational questions, and maybe a little bit of a thorny one. The first question we're going to deal with is, can we even take Genesis 1 seriously? Isn't it kind of outdated in this modern scientific age? Isn't it a myth? Isn't it a relic of a more ignorant time in history? Just as Christians share conversion stories, we share a testimony of how we came to Christ. Some unbelievers have what they call deconversion stories. And they'll share about how they grew up going to church. And they were raised in a religious home, and then at a certain point, they became enlightened. They left their childish faith behind and became an agnostic or an atheist. And often at the center of that crisis of faith is the miraculous. They can't believe in the miraculous anymore. It seems too far-fetched for them. And so they reject Christianity. And so Genesis is often cited by some as a reason for why people reject Christianity. We'll get that up there. There's a somewhat famous deconversion story of a man named John Loftus. John Loftus had been a devout Christian. He had been a pastor. He had studied as an apologist. He had studied under William Lane Craig, many of you know that name. And he writes this about the unraveling of his faith. He says, after a bunch of other things, he says, "So I began looking at the first chapter of Genesis. And as my thinking developed over time, I came to the conclusion that those chapters are folk literature, myth. Nearly 2 years later, and I came to deny the Christian faith. There were just too many individual problems that I had to balance, like spinning plates on sticks, in order to keep my faith. At some point, they just all came crashing down." So he cites Genesis 1 as a reason for losing faith. Now, that's not the whole story. There are some other factors involved in him leaving the faith, not just intellectual doubts. It came out later. It's very convenient for him to be doubting the Bible at the time that he was committing adultery against his wife, against the Lord. So there was a moral issue there, not just an intellectual issue. But nevertheless, some people do really have trouble with this first chapter of the Bible, because it seems, to many, it seems ridiculous. And so we should be ready to meet that challenge head on. And so that's the first thing I want to do this morning, is deal with that question. I'm going to deal with kind of two broad issues, and they would be on the screen. I don't know if we'll get that up there. The first question I want to deal with is just that. Can we take Genesis 1 seriously? Is it scientific? Can it be squared with what we know from science? Is it real history? And then the second question we're going to deal with today, and again, this is controversial among Christians, is should we read Genesis 1 literally? How should we take it? And I'm going to share some of the different ways that people have tried to understand Genesis 1. Just want to give a little disclaimer here. Maybe you're here this morning and you're thinking, well, I thought church was supposed to be this place about, you know, love and grace and the cross and that kind of thing. And you're totally right. What I want to say is that if you're here and you've got either a struggling marriage or you're wrestling with doubts or whatever, this is an important kind of message because some people, if you can't get past the first chapter of the Bible, the rest of the stuff doesn't make sense. If you can't get past Genesis 1 even, then all the stuff about the cross and grace, it's hard to accept. And so I'm hoping that this morning will kind of be a way to clear the table, kind of get rid of maybe a nagging question or doubt about can we even take the Bible seriously? And so I hope that is like that, that this will kind of get rid of those nagging doubts so that you can, you know, take Genesis 1 seriously and let God work in you through his word in the weeks to come. And so this morning is going to be a little bit more dealing with those kinds of questions. And then next week we'll get into more of kind of a Bible study going through each verse kind of approach. Well, let's start with that question. Can we take Genesis 1 seriously? Does it make sense to talk about God creating the universe? Every worldview has to make sense of how the universe came to be the way it is, why it exists. Some people are going to mock the biblical creation story, but they also have to answer the question of origin. Are we on there? Cool. Yeah. Can you move forward to the slide that says we have a universe on our hands? There we go. So everybody has to give an answer to the question of where did this come from? How do we make sense of this? And there are a couple options. Some Eastern religions insist that the universe is merely an illusion. It's not even real. And most people in American culture would reject that. It certainly seems real. So it's not an illusion. Others have said that the universe is eternal, that it has always existed. There was no beginning. And in the past, that was a popular view among scientists. And it was called the steady state theory, that the universe is just eternal. It just has always existed. In the last century, the steady state theory was roundly rejected by the scientific community because of some important discoveries. And I'm going to throw some scientific terms. You can, if you're not a science person, you can just let these go in one ear and out the other. But the second law of thermodynamics, Einstein's theory of general relativity, work by Edwin Hubble, remember the telescope named after him, some of this work by scientists persuaded the scientific community that the universe is not eternal. It has not always existed. It did have a beginning. And so now the standard model, the accepted view, is that the universe began to exist. It began to exist. It's not eternal. It's not an illusion. The universe began to exist in what is often referred to as the Big Bang. Now, some Christians get nervous about the Big Bang, but I want to suggest that the Big Bang is your friend. Okay, the Big Bang is your friend. Not every detail necessarily, but the Big Bang view actually confirms what Christians believe, that the universe began to exist out of nothing. An important question comes then. If you say the Big Bang, what could possibly bang a universe into existence? What could cause a universe to come into existence out of nothing? And I want to say here, as Christians, we have far superior resources to explain the beginning of a universe out of nothing than any other worldview. In the secular atheistic worldview, the universe came into existence apart from God. It couldn't have been caused by something in the universe because there was no universe yet. And so obviously universes can't cause themselves. So atheists are stuck with what I think is the impossible task of trying to explain how the universe, how everything, the universe is everything that exists. How could the universe have come into existence from nothing without a cause? Is the universe uncaused? Does that even make sense to say that everything that exists came into existence for no reason at all? Without a cause. That violates everything we know about the law of cause and effect. Greg Kokel says it's worse than magic. At least with magic, you have a magician and a hat. But this is worse than magic. There's no magician. There's no hat. Everything just pops into existence. And so we're left with, I would say the best science points to, a real universe that began to exist and has a cause. What might that cause be like? What could cause the universe? And this will come up on the screen here. There are a couple attributes of whatever that cause might be. The cause for the whole universe would have to be something that is itself outside of the universe. It would have to be outside of space and time. It can't be in the universe. It can't be material. It would have to be immaterial or spirit, because the universe includes all that is material. It would have to be itself uncaused. It would have to be extremely powerful to create such a big, vast universe. The cause for the universe would also have to be intelligent to create such a complex universe. And it would also have to be personal to initiate a creative act. Inanimate objects can't start doing anything. Now, if you notice those attributes, the cause for the universe would have to have those attributes. Those attributes are the attributes of God. Kind of a good little starting list there of some of the attributes of the God of the Bible. And so God is amazingly, actually, the very best explanation for the existence of the universe the way it is. The beginning of the universe is just one clue of creation. I'm going to give you a little list and we'll go more quickly through these others. Some other clues that God exists or clues that God is the creator include the fine-tuning of the universe. The fine-tuning of the universe. And again, I'm going to throw some science terms out at you. You don't need to remember the specifics, but at least get you thinking. That is the fine-tuning of the universe. There are several dozen built-in features of the universe. These are called constants. And they are tuned perfectly, just right, for life to exist on Earth. For example, the strength of the force of gravity is tuned precisely. If it was even a tiny bit stronger or even a tiny bit weaker, there would be no life on Earth. The same thing is true for several dozen other constants, including the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, the charge of an electron, the cosmological constant, and more. Now, it would be shocking. I mean, it would be startling that even one of these constants would fall within this narrow life-permitting range. For all of them to line up perfectly for life to exist is really against all natural explanation. It's downright impossible to explain. It's mind-boggling. To say that it all happened by accident, by chance, is irrational. Additionally, there are also dozens of features of our planet, of planet Earth, that are, again, fine-tuned for life, the design of the Earth. The Earth is just the right distance from the sun, spinning at just the right speed, at just the right tilt, in a solar system with just the right kind of star, with just the right atmosphere. The fact that we have plenty of water, which is necessary for life. The fact that we have a water cycle that kind of keeps a continuing, replenishing supply of water. And there are dozens of other features like this of our Earth. Again, it's fine-tuned so that we can be here. It was made for us. Other clues for creation include the origin of life. How, in an atheistic worldview, how did we get living organisms from inanimate matter? From just rocks and stuff? God is a better explanation than chance. We can also look at the incredible amount of information in DNA for even the simplest organism. Information always comes from a mind, never by chance. We can also look at scads and scads of creatures and features that simply defy any kind of Darwinian explanation through natural selection and mutation. Even if you have billions of years, there's just no way to explain how small steps and mutations can add new information to explain things like the human eye or the bacterial flagellar motor or the octopus's camouflage. There's one I was reading about this week that you ought to look up. There's a PBS video about the bombardier beetle. The bombardier beetle. Just write that down, bombardier beetle. You look it up later. Now, they're going to try and explain it through evolutionary terms, and I think it's just about laughable. It's just about laughable. It's really a stretch to explain how something so designed, so crafted, could come about just by accident. God also makes the most sense of things we know about the world. Human rights, free will, objective morality. These things don't fit in an atheistic worldview. God makes the best sense of the world as we experience it. And so it actually turns out that Genesis 1 is not outdated. It's not far-fetched. It's not ridiculous. On the contrary, the God hypothesis, the hypothesis that God created, actually makes the best sense of modern science and what we observe about the universe. And that's why the Bible says that it's the fool who says in his heart that there is no God. That's in the Psalms. And that God has made it plain to us that he's real, so that we're without excuse. And that's in Romans 1. There is certainly no reason for you as a Christian, if you're a Christian, there's certainly no reason for you to be ashamed of Genesis 1. On the contrary, I think we can be bold, and I think we ought to be familiar with some of the kinds of arguments I've just given an overview of here, and be ready to press atheists to give an explanation, to give an account of things that's reasonable to explain the universe the way we find it. I read a guy or listened to a guy this past week. He was saying that when he meets an atheist, he says, "Can I shake your hand? Congratulations on your faith. Congratulations on your faith. I could never have that much faith to believe all that the universe is, all the way everything fits together so perfectly, that it all just came about by accident. So congratulations on your faith. I don't have enough faith to believe that." Well, as I mentioned, Christians do have some kind of intramural debates among Christians about some of the specific details of creation. We're going to get to those next, but I want to just show here up front that there is broad agreement among all Christians on the most important questions. The most important questions regarding Genesis 1, the what, the who, and the why of creation, Christians are all in agreement. The what is creation out of nothing, or in Latin, creatio ex nihilo. We all agree God created out of nothing. The who, obviously, is God, and the why is not because God needed anything, but to show and to share his glory. So we agree on the what, the who, and the why. And Christians have united around these things since the very beginning. The quote will come up on the screen from the Nicene Creed in the 4th century. "We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible." There is disagreement among Christians over the questions of how and when God created. And if you've been a Christian for very long, perhaps you've been exposed to some of these issues. It can be, for some, very emotional, very controversial. And I'd say, unfortunately, it becomes very emotional and controversial. And so here's my plan for the rest of our time together. I'm going to lay out some of the different positions that Christians have held. I can't possibly get to all of them. There are dozens. There are many. But I want to share the main couple and give you just, again, some examples of some of the kinds of issues between the different views, the issues that people wrestle with. And then I'm going to share some thoughts about how we ought to handle this as a church, how we ought to interact with one another. And I'm going to make a strong appeal for charity, for grace to one another among brothers and sisters with different views. The question about Genesis 1 is an issue of interpretation. So all Christians agree on what Genesis 1 says. The question is, what does it mean, or how should it be understood? Some will ask the question this way: should we read the Genesis 1 literally? Should we read it literally? And so, again, I'm going to survey the main three views. Most views can be fit into one of these three categories, not all of them. But I want to say this. All three views that I'm going to share are held by people who love Jesus, who believe the gospel. All three are compatible with a high view of Scripture. That is, that it's the inspired, inerrant Word of God. All three views take science seriously, trying to harmonize what we read in Scripture with what we see in the world. And we want to say, as Christians, God reveals himself through the world, through nature, and also through the Bible. And so sometimes there's a contradiction or a tension for us, but the contradiction is not God's fault. The contradiction is in us. It's in our understanding. And so if we come upon some kind of contradiction between our reading of the Bible and our understanding of the science, then either one or both, our interpretation of one or both is wrong and should be adjusted. Well, I'm going to start with the most popular view throughout church history. It's still held by many, if not most, Christians today. And the first is young earth creationism, sometimes referred to as the literal interpretation view. Young earth creationism. In this view, the universe was created in six literal, consecutive, one after the other, 24-hour days, somewhere around a range here, 6,000 to 20,000 years ago. In this view, the universe and the earth itself are relatively young. We're talking thousands of years, not millions or billions. Young earth creationists will point out that this is the natural, straightforward reading of Genesis 1. The Hebrew word yom, which is translated day, means just that, the 24-hour day we're all familiar with, especially considering the phrase there was morning and there was evening and there was morning. And then there's also the ordinal word, the first or the fifth day. And so these must have been literal, normal 24-hour days. Young earth creationists will also point to God's command regarding the Sabbath in Exodus chapter 20 that shows that the creation days are normal days and a pattern for our work week. Just as God worked 6 days and rested one, that sets the pattern for us to work 6 days and rest on one. Now, some young earthers have gotten very specific, I would say carried away even, regarding trying to pinpoint the actual moment of when God created. And this is a little bit silly, and I don't want to suggest that all young earth creationists have this view. I don't want to lump all young earth creationists in this view, but some have gotten a little carried away. In the 1600s, there was a Bishop James Usher who published the date of 4004 BC as the year when God created. And it was actually printed in some Bibles on the timeline, as that was the date when God created. Another guy came along and proved on his math, figuring out that creation happened from October 19th to 24th in 4004 BC, and that Adam had been created on October 24th at 9 o'clock a.m., or maybe it was 6 o'clock p.m., I think. Okay, so obviously some silliness going on there. Again, not all young earth creationists should be lumped in with that. Okay, as I mentioned, young earth creationism has been the predominant view throughout church history. It was held by many of the church fathers and the reformers, including guys like Martin Luther and John Calvin. And it is still held today by brilliant, godly people in our own culture, including pastors John MacArthur, R.C. Sproul, John Piper. And I read a survey or heard a survey about half of American pastors are young earth creationists, about half of pastors. This view has also been popularized by the ministry Answers in Genesis and Ken Ham and their staff, which includes scientists with PhDs. And they run the Creation Museum and the Noah's Ark exhibit down in Kentucky, which draws visitors from around the world, including some from Aletheia have been there. So that's the first view. The second view I'm going to share is Old Earth creationism. Old Earth creationism. In this view, the universe is ancient, billions of years old, maybe about 13 to 15 billion years. And the earth then is not that old, but still very old compared to the young earth view. The earth would be about 4 to 5 billion years. Now, some people mistakenly assume that the old earth view is a new view, maybe as a reaction to Charles Darwin or some science or something like that. That's actually not the case. Way back in the early 400s A.D., Augustine of Hippo, in his famous book City of God, wrote this about the days of creation. What kind of days these were, it is extremely difficult or perhaps impossible to determine. And so there was debate even then over a millennium before Charles Darwin about how the Genesis days should be understood. You can actually go back even further to Clement of Alexandria, who was a church father living around 150 AD. And you can find, again, Christians who did not accept the young earth creationist view, that did not accept that position. There are also Jewish scholars and rabbis who had views other than a young earth view. So certainly some old earthers lean towards that view because of their interpretation of the scientific data. Because they think the science says this, therefore they have to change their interpretation of Genesis. And they'll cite things like the age of fossils, for example, dinosaur fossils, layers of rock, the age of light from distant stars, etc. But even before the science was out on those things, there were people that were questioning this literalistic reading of Genesis 1. And so they'll point to things in the text itself. There are things in Genesis 1 that have made some think that these days are not literal 24-hour days. And I'll share those in a moment. Let me first just mention a couple of subcategories of old earth creationism. And these are, I think, just maybe the most common that you'll run across. One is called the gap theory. The gap theory is an old earth view. It was popularized in the Scofield Reference Bible in the 1900s. And it's still held by some scholars today, including a guy named John Salehammer. It was possibly believed by one of the church fathers named Origen, who is a bit controversial in himself. In the gap theory view, there is a gap of perhaps billions of years between Genesis 1, verse 2, and chapter 1, verse 3, which maybe is a little bit of a stretch for you to even see it that way. But the first two verses of the Bible then would record God's creation of the universe. And then there's this gap of perhaps millions or billions of years in which some kind of worldwide catastrophe happened that's not described in the text. And that would all lead up then to day one, let there be light, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 3. So that these are actually literal days, but they actually are more of like a recreation, God recreating the earth that had been ruined in after chapter 1, verse 2. So that's the gap theory. There's another view called the day-age theory, or the day-age view. In this view, each day in Genesis is a symbol. It represents a longer period of time, perhaps millions or billions of years, so that, for example, day six was not really a day. It was actually a longer period of millions of years. God stretched out all that he did on day six over a long age. And then there's the day gap view. In this view, the days are actually 24 hours. They're literal literal days, but they're separated by long ages in between. And so they are literal days, but they're not consecutive. So there's day one and then millions of years or billions of years. Then there's day two and then millions of years or billions of years, day three, so on. There are numerous other categories and modifications that Christians have made with the old earth creationism views. Some people say, well, you don't think God could create in 6 days? Well, it's not what God could do. It's just what did God do? He could have created in 6 seconds, right? Or 1 second. The question is how to interpret Genesis. That's the big question, is how do we interpret this? Some pastors and Christian leaders that have a high view of the Bible, again, that it's inspired, that it's inerrant, have had an old earth creationism view, including and some heavy hitters here, J. Gresham Machen, Carl Henry, Francis Schaeffer, Gleason Archer, and then some contemporary scholars, Stephen Meyer. Teens, we watched the True You videos. Stephen Meyer, he's an old earth guy. Popular evangelical theologian Wayne Grudem holds the day-age view. And then there's also a ministry similar to Answers in Genesis, probably a little smaller, called Reasons to Believe. And that's led by a guy named Hugh Ross. They have a website. And he's also got a team of PhDs. So, okay, the third view I'm going to share is the literary framework view. So there's young earth creationism, old earth creationism, and then the third view is the literary framework view. And those who have this view will say that the other two views have kind of missed the point. They've kind of missed the whole context of Genesis 1. It was not written, they'll say, to be a scientific textbook. God could have revealed himself through a scientific textbook. He would have blown us all away. But instead, he chose to reveal himself and the details he wanted us to have about creation through what they'll call highly stylized literature, highly stylized. According to this view, Genesis 1 is a sort of theological poem, or a song, or they might say high prose. And so we read literature according to its literary genre. We shouldn't read Genesis 1 as if it was a science textbook, because it's not that. And they would argue that the original audience would have understood that Genesis 1 was more poetic, not with the wooden literalism of young earth creationism or the long ages of old earth creationism. People with this view don't read it as pure, like perfect, complete metaphor. They would say, for example, God is not a metaphor for something. God really exists. But this is a non-literal interpretation of Genesis 1. They are not literal days. They are poetic days or theological days or representative days or something like that. People who have this view would say that the Bible doesn't give an age of the earth. It doesn't give an age of the universe. It doesn't comment on that. So we can settle that matter some other way through science, or we don't need to pick a year. Here I want to give a little bit of some of the evidence that folks, and this would be evidence that would be cited by old earth creationists or those with a literary framework view, some things in the text that maybe would lead some to believe that Genesis 1 should not be interpreted in kind of a strict wooden literalism. Some reasons that Genesis 1 might be considered poetry. Well, first of all, there's no rhyme, but we're used to rhyme in our poetry, but Hebrew poetry would not have rhymed. So the things that they'll look for are repetition. Repetition is a feature of Hebrew poetry, and there are some repeated lines, almost musical, some would say. Then God said, "Let there be." Then there was. It was good. So maybe that's a bit of poetry there. People with a literary framework view would also point to parallelism as a feature of Hebrew poetry. And this will come up on the screen here. They'll draw this kind of parallel between days 1 through 3 with days 4 through 6, so that the first 3 days, God is kind of preparing a space. And then days 4 through 6, God is filling that space. So God forms the space, then God fills the space. And you can see that there's kind of correlation. There's light, and day 4 then is filling it with the sun, moon, and stars. Sea and sky then filled with birds and fish, and then land being filled with the animals and humans. So they'll cite that as an example of a feature of Hebrew poetry. People with a literary view will also look at certain days to conclude that they can't be literal days. For example, day 7 seems to not be a literal 24-hour day because it's never closed off. There's never a there was evening, there was morning. It never does that for day 7. We don't read that. And in fact, the book of Hebrews in Hebrews chapter 4 would lead one to believe that the day 7, the day of rest, the Sabbath rest of God, is still going on now. That it's still continuing, and that we can join it. But those who are in Christ join God's Sabbath. And so if day 7 is not literal, then perhaps other days are not literal. Some will also cite day 6, and I'm not saying all these are necessarily convincing. I'm just sharing some examples here. Day 6, some people would say day 6 couldn't be literal because there's too much happening. If you read in Genesis chapter 2, which we'll get to another week, Adam has to name all of the animals, which could potentially take way more than a 24-hour day. And then also, when he finally sees Eve, he's put to sleep, and then when he wakes up, Eve is there. And he says, "At last, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." Well, if the day is, you know, if he's less than 24 hours old, it seems like "at last" would be a little bit of a weird statement for him to make. So I'm not sure if that's convincing to you, but for some find that persuasive. Some will point to day 4 and say that how can these be literal 24-hour days when the sun isn't even created till day 4? 24-hour days are figured by the Earth's spin and rotation to the sun. Well, if there's no sun till day 4, again, this would cause some to say that these days must be non-literal. They'll point to day 3 and say that it says, God says, "Let the earth bring forth these plants." And so if the earth is bringing forth the plant, the seeds in the ground, that it would take more than 24 hours, obviously, for these seeds to germinate and sprout up above the ground. So maybe day 3 is not a literal day. And then even day 1, they'll say it's probably not literal because it seems like the earth actually exists before God says, "Let there be light." It says the earth was formless and void. And the spirit was hovering over the deep. Seems like hovering over the waters. And so it seems like there was earth and water even before day 1. So those are some of the features that people with the framework view would cite as for why they hold that view. And just want to clarify here, people that have this view are not saying that Genesis 1 isn't true. Literary frameworkers would say this is true, this is inspired by God, but the chief purpose of Genesis 1 is not to give us science, but to teach theology. And they'll, again, emphasize that this is the context is the people of Israel coming out of captivity in Egypt. And the thing that they need most is to catch a glimpse of God, of the glory of God, that God is above the sun. Remember, the Egyptians believed that the sun was a god. And so showing that God is sovereign over the sun, the creator of the sun, is kind of the point here. Okay. Some people that have had this view, again, some that have held this literary framework view include Pastor Tim Keller He wrote the book Counterfeit Gods that we studied in Life Group some years back. Also William Lane Craig, the apologist. And then there's a fairly influential book by two guys from Dallas Theological Seminary called In the Beginning We Misunderstood that advocates for the literary framework view. I'm going to put up a list of some issues that are discussed and debated between these different views. I'm not going to get into all of them. I can't possibly get into the details, but here's an idea of some of the discussion points that are debated back and forth. The one is the meaning of the Hebrew word yom. Is it day or is it some longer period? How to explain the appearance of age and different features of the earth and life. So again, the universe appears to be old. Certain things appear to be old. Young earth creationists are going to explain it, that God created, just as Adam was created with the appearance of age, God could have created the rest of creation with age. Or that maybe the flood, that the water pressure from the flood, that had kind of an aging impact on certain things. There's also the question of the reliability of the different dating methods for fossils and rocks. Is it really reliable when they say, you know, 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs, whatever. Is that even a legitimate way of measuring? Can we be accurate with that? There's also the question of animal death before the fall. And then, again, all of it comes back to this big question of what genre is Genesis 1? What genre is it? Okay, I want to deal with another kind of question related to this, and this is all in the interest of just understanding and helping us be gracious to one another if you meet somebody that has a different view than you have. And the question comes up, if Genesis 1 is not literal days, if day doesn't mean day like we normally think, does that diminish our confidence in the rest of the book of Genesis? Or does it diminish our confidence perhaps in the whole Bible? If you make those days of creation, if those are non-literal days, then is there kind of a slippery slope there of making other things non-literal? Does that mean Adam and Eve are not literal? Are they symbolic? Is the resurrection, is that a real thing? Maybe it's just a metaphor. Somebody might be concerned. And I'd just say not quite so fast. For those that have a non-literalistic interpretation of Genesis 1, that doesn't mean that they automatically make everything else in Genesis or the rest of the Bible a symbol or a metaphor for something else. Just like we would say when Jesus says that he's a gate for the sheep. We don't believe that Jesus is a literal gate. He was a human. He was God in the flesh. And it doesn't weaken our confidence in the rest of the Gospel of Matthew or the Gospel of John to say that Jesus was speaking metaphorically in that instance. So just to be clear here, some people will take Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, what was read for us this morning. They'll take that in a non-literal way. Some people will actually go to parts of Genesis chapter 2 and even parts of chapter 3 and say that those can also be interpreted in a non-literal way. That's not necessarily my view on some of those things. But anyway, the point is that taking parts of Genesis 1 in a non-literal way does not guarantee that you'll take other things in a non-literal way. I think most of us would say, with whatever literature you're working with, you assess each part, each book, each section, and determine what genre it is. And so I want to affirm here my view about that Adam and Eve are literal human beings. Jesus' genealogy is traced to Adam and Eve, and Jesus can't be descended from a myth. So even if somebody takes the literary framework view, that doesn't mean they necessarily don't believe in Adam and Eve as real people. Okay, enough on that. Let me make a few comments about just all three of the views again. Again, all three views have a high view of Scripture, that it is inspired, inerrant, authoritative. All three try to harmonize the reading of Scripture with science. All three views believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ, his life, death, and resurrection to save sinners. All three views are old. They have some church fathers and others throughout history who've held them, as well as more recent folks. And these are godly, intelligent scholars. And so none of these views should be ridiculed or just, you know, simply dismissed because I don't like it or whatever. All three views agree on the most important things, that God created all things out of nothing. They also agree on a number of theological ramifications of Genesis 1, which we'll get into next week, which I'm excited to get into next week. For example, God's power and sovereignty, that humans are God's special creation, that we're made in his image, etc. All three views also have some outliers, some difficult questions, some frayed strands that are just difficult to tie up completely. But if you're interested, there's this book will come up on the screen. I think this was in our church library at one time, unless somebody stole it. There's a book called The Genesis Debate, and it gives three views, the three views that I've presented, if you're interested in checking that out. And it's written in a cool format so that there are two scholars that will write on behalf of that view, each of those three views I mentioned. And then the other guys that wrote the other essays have a chance to respond and kind of give some feedback. So it's kind of an interesting format, but I found that helpful. Okay, well, let's lastly tackle this question of how should we handle this as a church? As individual Christians, how should we deal with this issue, knowing that people have different views? And I would just say, unfortunately, people have allowed this this question or these issues to become bigger than I think they need to be. In fact, sometimes it has led to name-calling, questioning the character or the biblical commitment of other Christians. And I think this is to our shame and our embarrassment. You know, I think the people that we ought to be focused on is unbelievers reaching out into the lost. And so I don't think this is a top-tier theological issue. I'm not really sure what the point is in some cases of really arguing vehemently for one particular view. So certainly there's the need for kindness. Jesus calls us to be unified, to mutual love for one another. And so to be calling people stupid or unbiblical or liberal or whatever the case may be, I think is really unhelpful. We're commanded throughout the New Testament to avoid needless arguments and quarrels, to avoid division. There has never been a creed or a council convened to say, this is the church's official view. Again, this is all three views have been held by people throughout the centuries. So I don't think there's a need for, you know, a dogmatism here. So I would say this is probably a third tier level question. You know, it's not top tier. And I don't even think it's second tier, second level. It's not a mark of orthodoxy. If somebody has the wrong view on this, it's not a heresy. And so at Aletheia, we try to live by the principle here. In essentials, unity. In non-essentials, liberty. And this isn't a non-essential, so there's liberty. You can have different views here among us. And in all things, charity. And so whatever your view is, hold it, I think, kind of loosely. Be willing to admit that others have some good points to make. And so at Aletheia, there's not like you have to have this view to be a member or to attend. There's nothing like that. We don't have a kind of statement of faith that includes a position on interpreting Genesis. There might even be some disagreement among the elder board. It's not an issue that really comes up very often, but it's something that potentially there could even be disagreement among our elder team. And obviously there's still unity and brotherhood among our elder team. I was listening to John Piper. He said he himself has a young earth view, but he's got men on his elder board that are old earthers. There are different organizations that work on intelligent design that have old earthers and young earthers working together. I think this is a model that we should strive for. I don't think it's helpful to get embroiled in arguments with each other while the rest of the world is perishing. We should be ready to defend God's creation, God as creator, with unbelievers. I'll just say I personally don't take a hard stance. Even studying this past couple weeks, I feel myself swayed back and forth by different things. And there's, again, some outliers for each one. So I just don't take a hard stance. And as a church, we don't take a hard stance. And I think there's some wisdom in that. I think that's appropriate. So just to say a couple things here then. Is this worth studying? Yes. Can you have a strong conviction about it? Yes. Is it worth developing a stance, like a stance that you really take? Maybe. Yeah, I don't know that you have to choose. Should you hold it pridefully? If you do pick a stance, should you hold it pridefully? I'd say no way. 1 Corinthians 13:2 says, if I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, but do not have love, I am nothing. So the overriding, the dominant thing has got to be love, charity, humility. Okay, I'm going to close with just a couple summary points, and then and we're going to watch a short video here. A couple concluding points, kind of application points. I want to say that all Christians should be ready to give a persuasive argument of why we believe in God and that God is the creator. I think we should all be prepared to do that. That's a standard thing. Christians have always believed that God exists, that God is the creator. And so I think some of the arguments I gave there at the beginning, I think we should be ready to do that. Maybe not in detail, all of those, but maybe you have one or two that you're armed with and ready to give a defense. We should also study, but not to the point of obsession, these different views on creation. And again, there are others. We should study, but not to the point of obsession. We should hold our own view loosely and engage brothers and sisters with humility and grace. And then lastly, this will kind of bleed into next week a little bit. Our hearts, when we think of creation, should be lifted to God in humble awe and gratitude as we consider the marvels of creation. God did not give us Genesis 1 so that we could argue with each other. He gave us Genesis 1 so that we would worship him, so we'd be amazed at him and his handiwork. And so what I want to invite you to do in your own life, whether you're going on a hike, if you're going on vacation to the ocean or going hiking in the mountains, or just walking around the block and looking up into the trees or watching a nature show on TV, to just marvel at God's handiwork, at his breathtaking wonders.